This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, and another pleasant morning for riding across the tar and cement and getting here. And it is a fourth Wednesday of the month. Apologies, by the way, for cutting off Stick Together, but it started late, apparently. So
hopefully you'll be able to get the whole interview on the podcast.
Yeah, and you can just repeat it on Saturday morning at 7 anyway, so you can pick it up there before Solidarity Breakfast and then listen right through. Hmm. Anne Maxwell was that voice who made that brilliant comment. I'm Kevin Healy. This is City Limits. And today we're going to talk in the second half of the program to Jack Howard, who's a Labor historian, or Labor has certainly a great knowledge of Labor history. And we're going to discuss with Jack the origins of May Day, because, of course, it's coming up. Those, I'm sure, listeners to this station know that May Day occurs this Friday. And also just reminisce on some of our May Days of the past here in Melbourne and what's happened to it and related matters. So we'll be talking to Jack in the second half of the program. And I did hope today to, and we will do it very shortly, talk about incinerators, but we just couldn't get onto the person involved. But because I was inspired by a sign I saw yesterday, Anne, which said Cleanaway, which is the company that wants to build these incinerators, and it said, making a sustainable future possible. And I thought, yes, that's partly true. I mean, Cleanaway could help make a sustainable future possible if it didn't exist.
But the fact clean itself away, do you think?
Yes, but the fact that it does exist is a bit of a problem. It of course, is also behind the Tullamarine toxic waste dump, which has been a running sore for years and not cleaned up. Cleanaway itself has 9 workers have died on their sites in the last 2 years. They got done a few years ago for having unsafe trucks. Mm-hmm. They got done for having scales that tended to be very much in their favour when they were weighing things at weighing stations. Not a great reputation, but they're making a sustainable future possible, which is great to know, isn't it? Cup of tea, Anne.
All things are possible. Yes, I'd love a cup of tea. I hope our late start doesn't mean the tea got cold.
No, it didn't. It still looks okay. I hope it's not too strong. Everything that was in the thing I put in, because it's getting mixed up the last few weeks between different sorts of tea. But anyway, so you've got one with a sort of cherry or plum or something, and one with sort of pink and different coloured flowers.
Can I go pink flowers today? Thank you.
Okay, pink flowers, that's you.
All right, reaching across. Right. Got it.
That's it. So that's that. There was also, just kicking off, we always have just something with the Herald Sun to kick off with, I suppose, but they had a story on Monday, virtually a full page, Brit soldiers slam BRS treatment, and this is the fact that Ben Robert Smith has been charged, and Ben Robert Smith VC, a sign, but two people holding the sign, a copper in the background or a security person of some sort.
Looking at the photo here.
Bit of an Aussie flag coming across from the right, but no one else. Now,
it's a bit of an empty space there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And they did say that about 300 people marched in a full-page story about, you know, how awful it is to actually charge this bloke. We have much, much bigger rallies very regularly about Palestine. They only make the Herald Sun if some controversy occurs, like someone says something they don't like, or a bit of a bash on with the coppers or something. But they never get a mention. Yet that, with 300 people, which is not much when you think about it, and no one else in the picture at all, full-page story and
they could get
banner.
Much better visuals from the Palestine marches.
And one might have thought, that's right, one might have thought that you know, in this case, rather than keep saying how he shouldn't be charged, we should just let the law take its course, and eventually he'll either be proven guilty or not guilty, and then maybe people can comment a bit, but until then I think people just let it go and see what happens.
No opinions in that headline.
No, not at all. You did say you wanted to say something about the NDIS, it struck me that I think the figure that really is interesting is $50 billion, I really think, because they're now saying they have to spend no more than $50 billion on NDIS, not taking into account the fact that it's being rorted by lots of people, and if they got rid of the rorts, they'd certainly be able to do a lot more with the money and use the money properly. What I find fascinating is that the same week as they announced that they had to reduce it to $50 billion, the defence minister, that giant mind, Richard Marles, you know, what a mind, Richard announced an increase in defence spending of $53 billion. Increase of 53. That's over and above the billions we already spend. And the $38 million a day for 30 years we're spending on AUKUS.
What could be the priorities of this government? It's so hard to discern,
isn't it? It's a bit hard to tell, isn't it? A bit hard to tell. But you did say you wanted to say something.
Well, you know, where I come at it, of course, from is the old modern monetary theory, which tells us that the federal government can never run out of the dollars. So they could spend the $50 billion if they have to on the subs or whatever, and they could continue to spend however much they need to give people with disabilities the services that they need. So there's no need to be cutting this, and the government doesn't need to run a surplus or a deficit in its budget. But aside from the fact that they don't need to save money, and this is just I think, a really good example of how this myth that they have to save money can actually do untold harm to people. And the number that interested me was the 160,000 people they intend to cut off from the NDIS.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. This is the part I don't get. Maybe you could explain it to me, Kevin.
No, probably not. But go on.
The part that they're saying that the reason they need to save money is these rorts that you were talking about. So from what I can tell, that's coming from the provider side. It's not coming from the side of the people who need the services.
That's right. And there are thousands of providers who are unregistered. And I mean, a simple way is to make them all be registered and have some degree of qualification and then be accountable totally for every cent they spend or use on their clients.
Yeah. So what they're saying is that they're not spending money enough on educating and training and registering and monitoring the supplier side.
That's right. So therefore you get rid of the people on it.
So therefore the solution is to pretend that people don't need the service.
That's right. That's it.
Oh, thank you for explaining that.
Yeah, that's all sorted.
Okay.
It is ridiculous, isn't it? But also on spending on things that matter, like killing people, AUKUS has hit a bit of a problem because Britain's got a report just come out, and in fact this morning's Financial Review's got a headline: AUKUS is in trouble, warns British probe. And there was an interview with a bloke about it this morning on Radio National earlier.
Okay.
A British Labour politician who thinks AUKUS is the best thing since sliced bread, by the way, and we have to really, the three leaders must get together and make it work so we can go on killing people. But also, America is getting further and further behind in its shipbuilding. And as Trump makes more demands for various types of war, virtues of death, war things, it's getting further behind. So I think we just have to agree that we're never going to see it, and what the hell, and let's use that. That money could well go to $38 million a day would be a fair kick to NDIS, for instance, or
it would be
public housing, or
but again,
yeah,
they can spend money on both if they need to. In fact, I kind of don't mind that they're distracting themselves on something that won't work militarily. It's like let them go for it, because if nothing's going to come of it, that's probably a good outcome.
It probably is, although the the fact that they're falling behind, and yet it's, and they say, you know, that America's still looking not quite enough money to build these things, and yet we're giving them billions and billions of dollars of our money to their shipbuilding industries, and yet they still say they need more money. So it's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, they need to figure out how the money works.
Yeah, there you are.
I mean, because America can't run out of dollars either.
Now, I mentioned a while ago that that there were people betting on when he would attack Iran, and there's a betting mob who take bets on things around the world, and people made a big killing, and there was some suggestion there could have been the odd killing, almost not meant to be a pun, but some suggestion there might have been the odd touch of insider trading going on, knowing when he was going to announce the thing, because the people were betting on when he would, and they got it spot on, and made a hell of a lot of money with this mob.
How leaky is this White House?
Yes, well, also I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that Pete Hegseth, that another, he's sort of the equivalent giant mind of our Richard Miles. He's the Secretary for War, of course, and Pete also, just before the Iran attack, ordered his broker to buy lots and lots of shares in the Merchants of Death companies that were going to be involved. But again, just pure coincidence.
No conflict of interest there.
Oh, no, none whatever. Hmm. Just pure absolute coincidence.
Coincidence. And nobody's making money in the Trump administration, are they?
No, well, last week also, because Trump, of course, you know, this minute he says it's about to finish and something's happening. And so every 10 minutes, he contradicts what he said 10 minutes ago. We know that. Mm. But he made a statement that the war was going to finish shortly, which always sends the price of oil soaring. And then he has something else which sends it down. Well, 5 minutes before one of these statements, a number of people moved in on the oil market with this same mob who bet on all these things. And McGinn made a killing because it went the way they thought it would go because of what Trump said 5 minutes later. 5 minutes. What luck in that 5 minutes. Not that I'm suggesting there's any insider trading going on here at all.
Oh, day traders are having a field day, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's wonderful, isn't it? But also the other fact is, I mean, it gets ridiculous, but as you know, the World Cup's coming up, the Soccer World Cup. Well, as people who love soccer would say, it's the only World Cup. But anyway, it's coming up and it's being played in North America, and the games are being shared across Canada, United States and Mexico. And because, of course, well, the United States, as we know, Donald would tell you, was the most important one there, and the others are really just states anyway of the United States. So,
vassals.
That's right, vassals. So the Italy, which has been a regular in the World Cup, in fact, just as an aside, just as an absolute aside, many years ago I landed in Italy at sort of mid-afternoon or something, and night time. No, it was, we got into a pub at sort of about tea time, and there was commotion going on everywhere. And I discovered that it was a World Cup, and Italy was playing one of the matches, and then Italy won, and I went out into Rome, and mostly little Fiats, where everyone with a flag at the top, Italian flag, all converged on the centre, so that no one could move, because by the time I got to the centre, everyone was facing different directions. The coppers were totally lost. But there's massive celebration because they'd won an early game in a World Cup.
What a moment.
They take it seriously. But this year, and in the previous World Cup, they got knocked out before they didn't even make the final stage. Terrible thing. But Iran, incredibly, has made the final stage.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
But now Donald says Iran should be thrown out and Italy bought in because of their long-term record. And even though they lost and didn't qualify, they should just get in anyway. And Iran, which qualified, should be thrown out.
Don't you just love living in a world that's subjected to the whims of one person?
That's right. So Donald's got that one sorted out, the World Cup.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I was listening the other day to recently to a podcast, and they were talking about the whims and things that Florida, the state of Florida in the United States, has now declared that they'll no longer, pretty much no longer, be teaching sociology in any of the universities there.
It's dangerous.
No, you don't want people to know how societies work and why some people are rich and some people are poor and all that sort of thing.
They might have to think. It's dangerous.
So anything you don't like the look of, just get rid of it. Oh,
no, that's I agree with Florida there. Get rid of that stuff. On the question of war, etc. Also, of course, they've now killed at least 185 people in these attacks on boats in the Caribbean that they claim are narco terrorists or whatever, when they're probably just fishermen and they're slaughtering, but it doesn't matter. But there's some suggestion that might be a touch illegal. Well, I think more than a touch, I think it's 100% illegal, but that's
another matter. Shoot first and ask questions later.
And on top of that, $53 billion, by the way, we're pleased to know that Richard also announced this week another $1.2 billion to buy defence vehicles from Thales, that Thales, the French merchant of death company. So that's good. That's another $1.2 billion because those vehicles will be useful to us, and they create 450 jobs in Bendigo and Brisbane. Isn't that good?
450 jobs.
Yeah. But even Israel has now been forced to back off a little bit, well, very little bit, but when a photo was released of a soldier, an Israeli soldier, hammering and smashing a wooden statue of Jesus, which got a few people upset.
Well, that crosses the line for some people. Crossed a line.
Good point, cross, yeah.
pun intended there, Kevin.
And in Lebanon, and Benjamin was forced to say it was a bit ordinary and it shouldn't have happened and all that, so isn't that wonderful? This one will surprise you, Anne. But,
I come here to be surprised, Kevin.
Yeah, well, this one's really going to surprise you. But Google and Meta, those two big IT companies, and these days, AI type companies, are shifting their profits offshore. $11 billion offshore and only $140 million in tax to Australia. isn't that amazing? And it does point out that the act of sending your transferring your money overseas to your own subsidiary might be deemed to be a tax dodge, but only if it can be proven it's a tax dodge, of course, and not that it's such. But you'll be pleased to know that Google managed to what did it do?
This is do no evil Google.
Yeah, Google advertising revenues rose this is the last year, $731 million, up 10%. Reselling cloud storage yielded $399 million, up 34%. Hosting services made $265 million, up 29%. Google paid $9.4 billion to its own entities in service fees, up 14%. somehow didn't seem to manage to pay much tax on any of that.
They've got all those expenses.
Yes, that's well. I'm not suggesting there's anything going on there, except that they're not paying any tax. In fact, the inquiry into the gas industry last week, but thankfully our government's already said now it won't tax the gas industry because it's dangerous. It thwarts investment for a start. but of course,
thwarting investment into fossil fuels. Want that, would you?
No. But they also borrow money to invest with the big companies like Woodside and Chevron and co, with their big developments that the West Australian government says are so important and our government says are so important, because we have to have transition to our transition to climate, to well, climate change, if there is such a thing, to clean energy. But the only way to get to clean energy with transition is to transition from gas. And to get transition from gas, you've got to have gas.
Yes.
Or coal or oil or whatever.
Of course you do.
Yes, you can't transition unless you've got something to transition from.
It's like saying
from.
You have to go from Melbourne to Sydney via Perth. It just has to be done.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Well, Perth's the key to all this, of course. But they to establish those places, they borrow massive amounts of money from their own company in America, a tax dodge haven somewhere around the world where they've got headquarters. They borrow from themselves, and it was pointed out that when the interest rates were 1.something%, they were paying 14% or 15% interest to their own company, which meant that they had years before they had to pay any tax at all in Australia, or still have, I think, years before they have to pay any tax at all in Australia because they've got all these big debts, and so that's just offsets the tax. Isn't it amazing how these things work?
I love creative accounting.
Yes.
It's a work of art.
Are you calling that creative accounting?
Surely not. No, this is just business. This is just how you need to do things.
That's right. I mean, just happens to be the way of the world, really. Now, also, the advocates of AI suggest that it's going to create 935,000 jobs here in Australia. Now, they actually say it underpins 935,000 jobs.
Okay.
But it's
different from creating, yeah, Kevin.
It's a slight obfuscation, put it that way. It actually doesn't. The 965 figure is simply the Tech Council of Australia's estimate of total technology sector employment, a count that includes everyone from hard software developers to graphic designers to HR managers and PR staff at internet publishing companies. The report does not demonstrate that these roles depend on data centres being physically built in Australia.
Mm.
Good heavens, don't tell me that...
There's a little note to
yes,
self.
Yes, that's strange, isn't it? Mm.
Does it include jobs like truck drivers having to deliver water around to these places because there won't be any left by the time they're done? That's right,
all that, yes, electricity. And they also, it is quite amazing because They somehow claim that one of them actually claimed that they're going to help in the transition, apparently, because I don't know why, because I suppose if you use that much electricity, there'd be none left. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how you help in the transition when you're creating massive pollution.
Well, we're going to transition to candles. I think that's the idea.
That's one possibility, yeah. Well, probably be better off, actually. But around the world, people are, in fact, turning against them. I mean, people who live near them, for a start, are pretty upset. But around the world, people are, and even in America, in various states, they're sort of getting up to the set and saying no and demanding, making certainly all sorts of demands on them. Mm. And in fact, this week, though, Microsoft said it's going to spend $25 billion here in Australia on them. And of course, we've got state and federal governments screaming out and wanting them desperately at the same time as they say we have to control them. But then they say they won't, you know, jobs are going to go. Mm. But the man from Mr. Nadella, the man from Microsoft, said upheaval in the job market from artificial intelligence was inevitable but not destructive if companies like his worked with governments to ensure there were societal benefits from the investments being made. Can you just explain that for me, thanks, Anne?
That was too hard for me. Societal benefits. Oh, my gosh.
I think that means the government has to pick up the bill for the lost jobs.
Yes, that would be the societal benefit.
We get rid of the jobs and you pick up the problem.
Well, as long as there's a benefit to the Microsoft employees and the politicians. I can't see a problem with that.
Oh, no, 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 that's right. And in fact, Microsoft culled, well, nice word, cull, isn't it? Sacked 15,000 workers globally last year, including many in Australia. So they're getting into, at least they're starting to practice their own stuff. You know, but they keep saying all the time, but you know, it will sort itself out. It will create other jobs. It's always going to create other jobs. But I keep saying, well, you know, when they got rid of capital punishment, what other jobs did the hangman get, for instance? You know.
He got to teach the Boy Scouts how to tie knots.
Oh, right, yeah. And you'll also be pleased to know, before we go to a break and go to Jack Howard, that the handout, the tax break for electric vehicles, and it's a good cause, but it's blown out to $1.4 billion. The problem is that the only people that can afford the electric vehicles and the tax break on massive salaries. They've discovered that the majority of people, about a third of the people gaining from this tax break, are on the highest salaries in Australia.
I am surprised.
Yes, so there you are. It's helping a particular group of people. And just to wind up here, a bloke called Richard Brandweiner has just been named the head of the Chief Investment Officer of the Future Fund, that body, that very strange body that Peter Costello set up, and which has heaps and heaps of money and which could well be used, in fact, to fund things like NDIS, I would have thought.
When people mention Future Fund,
my blood
pressure goes up.
They've put this bloke in because the previous bloke left and there was a bit of a cloud about his management skills, apparently.
Okay.
But the bloke they've just appointed, they've apparently gone through a whole lot of people they interviewing process. He worked at a place mob called Pendle, which is some sort of investment mob. And during his time, he was named in a lawsuit that alleged he and the asset management firm had mishandled bullying complaints and had made the complainant redundant for raising the issue. So yeah, that's his qualification. He's got the job.
That's going to solve any management style issues,
That should sort that one out, shouldn't it? So I thought that was pretty interesting. Okay, look, we'll take a break, come back and have a yarn to Jack Howard.
Friday, May 1st, is May Day, International Workers' Day. Join 3CR all day in our 50th year of coverage in solidarity with the continued struggle for labour rights and fair working conditions for all our communities around the world.
We got May Day specials from regular Friday shows and special presentations from 3CR's programmers from across the grid. For more info, head to www.3cr.org.au/May Day 2026.
Friday, May the 1st.
Tune in all day right here on 3CR.
We are back. It is City Limits with Anne and Kevin, and we have a conversation coming up, I believe.
With Jack Howard, yeah. Jack's, he's officially called a Labor historian, but his knowledge of Labor history is quite deep. And Jack, just that last little promo we had there, whatever happened to the eight-hour day? Can you answer that? Whatever happened to the eight-hour day, Jack?
Yeah, good morning, comrades, and preemptive happy May Day to all the listeners out there. It's a good question. I mean, Australia had one of the strongest organised trade union movements of any country in the world in the late 19th century. It was stonemasons in Melbourne and Sydney who were the first group of workers in the world to officially win an eight-hour working day in 1856. And from about the time of the 1891 Shearers' Strike onwards, May 1st or May Day was celebrated and commemorated by workers in Australia marching off the job. marching and using that as, I guess, sort of a rallying point to continue to fight for their rights and dignity at work and a better society. Your listeners who either know history or have a good memory who are around at the time would also know that it was in May 1969, following the jailing of the Victorian Tramways Union leader Clary O'Shea, for Clary's defiance and his refusal to submit and pay the union's penal fines for striking, that the a general strike broke out. An organised general strike occurred, which successfully forced the establishment, the powers that be, to free Clary from jail and to give up ever trying to enforce those penal powers again. These penal powers, which had been, I think, legislated in the 1950s under Menzies, they were like a dead hand over the organised working class in Australia, effectively penalising, fining and criminalising the right to strike. And the May 1969 general strike, which occurred around about the time of May 1st or May Day or soon after that those events occurred, successfully broke those shackles that had held back Australian workers and unions and allowed them to go and strike without these fines being imposed. Why has May Day died down over the years? I remember Trevor Dobbin used to be the Victorian State Secretary of the Rail, Tram and Bus Union. He's been in the movement since, you know, the 1970s, and he said that, you know, from the time he was living in an agitator in Townsville, you know, May Day rallies have just gotten smaller and smaller and smaller every decade and every year. The simplest answer is the decline of the unions, and especially as the decline of unions from the time of Hawke government and the Accord onwards.
I want to come to that, but let's go back to the origins. Why is May the 1st May Day? How did it become the Workers' Day?
Yeah, well, actually, that's a good question. I have to say, I should know, I'm not entirely sure why it was the first day of May rather than any other month. But in 1886, Labor Unions in the United States planned a massive general strike for the 8-hour day on the 1st of May. And in the event, between 300,000 and half a million workers in the US took strike action on that day. Several days later, you had this atrocity, this incident, where an unknown figure threw dynamite from the crowd, I think in Chicago. That was at Haymarket, if I'm not wrong. I think that was a Haymarket incident. Where
Chicago
an unknown
was
figure,
the start of it all, yeah.
That's right. I think it was an unknown figure who may very well have been a police agent provocateur threw dynamite from the crowd. People were killed, but subsequently a couple of working-class militants and political anarchists, Sacco and Vanzetti, were framed by the state, charged with having thrown the dynamite, and that was used to condemn them to death and execute them. I think that's what happened. So I believe it was because the labor unions in America chose May 1st as their rallying day. I think that that is the origins of May Day, which you having introduced me so kindly, Kevin, I really should be a lot more definitive about.
Yes, Jack, you should. But that's basically it, and so it became the Workers' Day. You mentioned also, though, that in the late 1890s, how the workers celebrated. Did they, in fact, take that day every day, every year, on the day itself, on May the 1st?
In Australia, it varies state by state. In Victoria, no. I mean, originally May 1st, it may be that sections of workers did walk off the job or take the day off, but I don't believe May Day or May 1st has ever been a public holiday in Victoria. I believe it... Sorry, again, this is something I should know, and please enlighten me, comrades, if you know. I think possibly in Queensland it might be, which... so I should know, but I don't think May the 1st has ever been made a public holiday, or certainly not the historic organised labour movement has ever succeeded in forcing it or legislating it as a public holiday in any state or territory. Several years ago, Kevin, you know, in Victoria you had the May Day Committee organised May Day March every Sunday following May the 1st here, and it was back in about 2021. It just so happened that May 1st in 2021, May 1st fell on a Saturday. With no disrespect to the comrades in the May Day Committee who've done really important work keeping it going, but a number of folks, including me, felt that we should do the May Day March on Saturday, May 1st. part of a struggle to try and make May Day a public holiday and reclaim the tradition. So we had a reasonable turnout, a several hundred and lively march on Saturday, May 1st, but that was fortuitous because May 1st fell on a weekend day like that. So, yeah, there can't be any question, I think, of making May Day a public holiday until we've built a lively, strong and combative union movement and organised workers' movement in this country again. And part of it is actually reclaiming the spirit and the tradition of May Day as much as anything else before I think we can think about fighting or campaigning to make it a public holiday, if that's what the view of comrades in the movement turns out to be.
Yeah, it's rather interesting, isn't it, that 2 weeks after we have the Anzac Day holiday and all the pro-military rubbish that surrounds it, we then have May Day, and the media here deliberately goes out of its way, I think, to make sure that no one knows it is the International Workers' Day.
Certainly, you wouldn't know it at all unless you followed, on Trades Hall or the union movement on social media or anything like that. Otherwise, there's zero regular mainstream media coverage of its significance at all. I don't know. The Queensland union movement still does a lively May Day march, I think, on the weekend following May the 1st. And I don't know if that gets any much media coverage in Queensland or not, but otherwise you just wouldn't know it happened at all here.
No, unless there's some sort of ruckus between the coppers or something, but then that might make it, yeah. That often happens, in fact, in terms of, because of where we are at the international dateline, often by a couple of days later you get stories around May Day if there's some sort of riot overseas or something, but that's the best you get.
Yes, that's right. I think it's worth noting, in the context of Israel's continuing genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the terrible war that's still unfolding and escalating in the Middle East. In Italy last year, we saw something momentously important and inspiring. The trade unions in Italy and parts of Italy generally are stronger, better organised, more militant, and still have more relevance in Italy than in Australia generally. It was around September last year, I think, in response to Israel's attacks on the Samud humanitarian flotilla that was setting sail to Gaza, that work unions in, mainly in the city of Genoa, that's one of the maritime port cities in Genoa, organised a general strike, started in the wharves and the docks, but became a citywide general strike in Genoa, and then became a general strike or strike spread to other cities in big, big parts of Italy. That was the first political general strike I think we've seen in any part of any Western country, a political general strike in perhaps decades there. It was incredibly inspiring, very important, I think, for unions, unionist activists and socialists world over to witness that and be inspired and draw the lessons from it. And I think there was one of the placards that's visible in Genoa and Italy during that general strike. It said words to the effect of, we came to free Palestine, but Palestine has freed us.
Mm. Yeah, well, if we're going to reminisce on May Days, by the way, a nice little story. I was in Rome, speaking of Italy, on a May Day in the early 80s, and it was the time of the Eritrean situation. But there was a bloke, I don't know if you're a bit earlier your time, Jack, but a bloke called Ignazio Salemi, who was a Philef journalist who came to Australia. And Fraser then wanted to get rid of him, and he went underground here for a while. He ultimately married a woman called Kathy D'Angelo, who worked for the Railways Union at the time. And they moved to Italy. And some years earlier, I'd met them in Italy, and then I was back there. And the night before May Day, we had dinner together. And Ignazio said, oh, you'll find it interesting here tomorrow, he said, because here they rotate the speakers from the political party. So unlike Australia, the speaker in Rome that year was from the Christian Democrats, the liberal sort of party over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, so you'll find it interesting. I said, oh, yeah. So we joined the May Day march, and the Eritreans were up the front, and those wonderful colours that Africans can get. I remember the stunning green colours, etc. It was wonderful to see. But when we got to the park where it was held, and they announced this Christian Democrat who was going to speak, these young blokes rushed up the front, set up their own platform, got out a megaphone, and then started throwing things at him and shouting him down. And he arrived with a 20-minute speech. He wasn't going to be deterred. He went on for 20 minutes while these missiles were hurled at him for 20 minutes and these young blokes were screaming him down.
Anyway,
that's one of my experiences of May Day. But that was
very good. May Day is a politically contested space. Well, good on them, I say, and down with the historic compromise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that, by the way, at an earlier time there, Philip had organised for us to... I was on a delegation previously, some years earlier, on our way to Libya, actually. And we spent some time in Rome on the way. And Philip arranged for us to meet the executive of the Italian Communist Party, the PCI. And they all turned up in their suit looking very bureaucratic. And they got their economic specialist to tell us what was going on and where it was all heading. And his final line was, and then we shall have reached the ideal situation, democratic capitalism. And I thought, well, hang on, fell off my chair and then asked a few questions and thought, and I think I asked a few nasty questions, and I rather think that I thought I'll get back and Philip will be most upset. But they said, oh, they said it was very good, you know, all that sort of thing. But democratic capitalism, is that the answer, Jack?
No, certainly not. And it's that kind of commitment to reforming the system rather than trying to overthrow it and change it and channeling the power of the workers to do so that has led the working class and the organised union movement in practically all Western countries into the quagmire, into the dead alley, which it's in today. And it's principally the so-called leaders of the official leadership of the union movement in this country and other countries like Australia, and the integration of parties like the Australian Labor Party, which has led to this present state of decline. That's not to say that the decline will be with us indefinitely, though. There'll be an upturn, I'm sure, in workers' struggles in this country today. And I imagine that when it does erupt, it will erupt in spectacular and imaginative and unexpected ways that will take people like you and I by surprise. And hopefully that will point the way forward to reviving the spirit of struggle, prefiguring the kind of equal and harmonious and just and environmentally sustainable kind of society and world we want to live in, and overthrowing the kind of system and order we live in, the capitalist order, and building a new kind of order in its place.
Now, I go back, of course, to the May Day marches in the Vietnam War period, when we used to massive marches down to the Yarra Bank, which is now, of course, given over to the tennis people, the elite of town. But they were massive in those days, and, you know, union banners and union the various ethnic groups would march in their ethnic groups, the massive groups providing food at the end of it all, but just huge marches, and they've just declined so much over the years. You did mention about the Accord and the Hawke Keating impact on trade unionism. Could you go into that a bit?
Yes.
Because that seems to me to be where the decline kicked off.
Yeah. Well, with the return of the ALP to federal government in 1983 under Bob Hawke, already before the Hawke government took office, you had the framework between the ALP and the unions, or most unions, through the ACTU of what was called the Prizes and Incomes Accord. The basic premise of the accord was wage rises are the cause of inflation that the Australian economy is going through. Therefore, unions must agree to exercise wage restraint, not strike or pursue higher wage claims, no matter if that leaves workers and their members, you know, under the cost of living. And in return, the Hawke government will work with the unions and other community groups to keep workers' living standards at pace and decent while the economy recovers. In the event it didn't work out like that at all, what it meant was that workers' wages and living standards were held down, while Australian big capital recovered its profit margins, and the Hawke government, a so-called Labor government, oversaw the biggest transfer, upwards transfer, of wealth from workers and labour to capital that any period of Australian history has seen. The consequence too was this: you had unions practically policing their own members or not really doing anything to encourage them or defend even their basic interests of living standards or basic interests at work. Naturally, that will make unions lose their relevance. Workers will think, well, what's the point of belonging to a union? And as young workers come into the workforce, they'll think, what's the point of a union anyway? And we'll never join or get brought into it anyway. So you've seen a pretty constant secular decline of unionism in Australia since the 1980s and 1990s onwards. That's not to say that it's all been a constantly downward trend. There have been certain spots or patches where unions in some sectors in the public sector and certain other areas have, however stubbornly and in an incremental way, have turned around their membership figures, even year by year. But the overall pattern has been one of clear downward decline in union membership. Not to mention days lost to strike, work days lost to strikes.
And of course, it allowed. I know this week in an article, Prue Goward, who's very, as we know, very conservative, feature article she had in the Fin Review, praised the Hawke-Keating government and said it paved the way for John Howard to go even further. Course, they did. The Hawke, the Reith legislation of 1996, and that really led up ultimately to work choices, which really made unions acting as unions illegal, didn't it, effectively?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, Prue Goward is only about the 2031st Liberal to
make
praise
that point.
And
that's
make,
right.
make the point that the Hawke and Keating governments did most of John Howard's work for him, and after that it was almost just a tidying up operation for John Howard. And, of course, the Hawke and Keating governments floated the dollar, deregulated the banks, privatised state assets, and oversaw the transition from industry-wide bargaining, I guess it's what we would call it, to enterprise bargaining. And they were able to do that all the more successfully than probably any Liberal government attempting to have been able to do so, because they had the consent and support of the ACTU and most of the leadership of the Australian Union movement who enforced it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's a point that Elizabeth Humphreys makes in her book about that period. That Labor was able to do it because of its contact with the union, of course, with the ACTU in particular.
Yes, well and truly. It's corporatism in action, and corporatism has not gone away ever since, really.
Yeah, well, I knew militant union leaders at that period who wanted to take militant action, but they were actually controlled by the ACTU and told, you know, pull your head in, don't do it.
Yep, that's right. I wish we could leave your listeners with a happier, more optimistic note and, you know, encourage them to struggle on. Kevin and I would hate them to just go away from this thinking, therefore unions are no good. What's the point? Their leaders are corrupt. Well, the only way you're going to make a difference is belong to your union at work, organise your workplace, work within your union to demonstrate that you win more by fighting and to give your workmates and your fellow union members and union activists greater confidence. Don't despair. Yeah.
And we are seeing signs. We're seeing the teachers. We're seeing you know, the changeover of the state public sector union, for instance.
Yes, we have. That's right.
There's signs that there are green shoots out there.
Yes, there definitely are. And look, the important change of leadership That's right. Exactly. Red shoots. The change of leadership in the Victorian Public Sector Union from a very long-standing, ineffectual and stale leadership under Karen Batt to the new kind of reform ticket that's come in. That's been a very important change, probably the most important kind of change that's happened in Victorian union politics in a decade or two. So I look forward to seeing what eventuates from that. I'm not letting cat out of bag by saying to inform viewers that there is a election going on in the United Workers Union at the moment, and I guess we'll just see what happens there.
Yeah, that's right. There was an interview about it the other day on maybe Stick Together or something, but I heard it.
Yeah.
You'll be pleased to know, by the way, Jack, that the CFMEU organised to its workers to take Monday off because we missed out on the Anzac Day public holiday because it happened at the weekend.
Yeah.
Now, the Herald Sun had a headline on this that was pretty pro-worker. It said, "Honour Anzacs by bludging." Bludging.
Yeah,
CFMEU orders four-day weekend on big build by bludging. Yeah. Now, the other states, there were four other states, or the ACTU and I think three other states, had public holidays on that day in which workers didn't go to work. So was every worker in those states bludging?
Oh, of course they were, Kevin. Also, I can't believe we've gotten this far into the conversation without having talked about the CFMEU and the administration regime in there yet.
And it's changed.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's right. No matter what we think about the jingoism and agenda behind Anzac Day, the fact is the union is strong enough to get their members a day off like that, and that should be the entitlement of every worker where there's a public holiday which happens to fall on a weekend. So it's the classic thing of trying to get other people and other groups of workers reading the Herald Sun to resent the CFMU and resent construction workers for being able to get a day off while they don't. That's very much the narrative we've been seeing running through the whole of this massive attack on the CFMU and unionism in construction administration. A lot of it has been about trying to play off the resentment of people out there, especially people in, you know, white-collar occupations, people who might have a uni degree or something like that, but who aren't on a great salary and are feeling, you know, the mortgage and cost of living pressures really, really squeeze them. It's about making them resent and blame construction workers and resent the fact that a construction worker who maybe, you know, never finished high school, let alone has a university degree, is making much more, much better money, and has much better outcomes in life than they do, and thinking that it must be the CFMEU and construction workers' fault squeezing and taking money away from me who has a university degree. It's a classical thing of trying to make white-collar workers see themselves as a privileged middle class, which is bullshit, and blame others instead. That's been so much of what the ideological narrative is that's been running through administration and the so-called CFMEU scandal of the last year or two.
Yeah, and rather than see it as the strength of unions, that you can get that sort of situation for workers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. The CFMEU is one of the last, not the only, but one of the last unions in Australia that can fight effectively for its members in what is a dirty and still, at times, very dangerous industry. That's the whole significance of it. That's the most important thing about the CFMEU.
And, of course, there's been a change over there in the last couple of days. Irvine's resigned.
Yep, Mark Irving's gone.
And Irving's resigned. And so they're going into new territory again.
Yeah, that's right.
Or perhaps the old territory in a new name.
Exactly right, exactly. The most important thing we can do, though, is keep campaigning and fighting for the administration and the attempted destruction of a CFMU to end, and democratic sovereignty over the CFMU to be properly restored to its members. And we should keep fighting for that. And if or when administration does come to an end, do all we can to support the CFMU, its members, its stalwarts and the people who've committed often their lives to the union to make sure that the union's rightfully theirs returns to them and in no way emerges from this weaker than it did before.
Yeah, we need much more strength. There was earlier today I heard an item in which they referred to, it was David Shoebridge actually talking about the green bands and Mundy and the builders' labourers in New South Wales and what they saved by the action they took. But, of course, that sort of action today would be seen as illegal.
Absolutely.
And the union, so that they're the sort of laws that still need to be changed dramatically.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack Mundy would have gone to jail today very quickly if the kind of legislation which is now in place had been enforced. So, yeah, that's so much of a challenge and what we have to fight to undo and undo by acting in defiance of the laws as they stand.
Yeah, it seems to me that when Reith and Howard moved in the mid-90s and then moved on to Work Choices somewhat later, that's when the union sort of stood up and said, we're not going to cop this, wasn't it? I mean,
That was important. The maritime dispute, the war on the waterfront was really important, even if, unfortunately, the deal that was agreed to did lead to a huge decline in secure permanent jobs on the wharves. They still defeated, it was still an important defeat and victory for the workers in the sense that Howard and Reece's attempt to completely destroy and break the MUA on the waterfront and use that to presage further attacks on unions and workers elsewhere in the Australian workforce was defeated. That does matter.
Yeah. Jack, we're running out of time, but May Day's coming up. It's Friday, and we've got events happening in Melbourne as well with a march on Sunday. Can you tell us a bit about that and what we should be doing?
Yes, it's the annual Sunday May Day march organised by May Day Committee at Trades Hall, outside Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street in Carlton. So please come on, come all. Bring your union colours, your union T-shirts and union clothes, if you've got some. If you can, bring your union flags and banners along. And yes, we'll march and hear speeches to keep the traditions alive. Remember the workers who fought and sacrificed and keep fighting for the emancipation and self-emancipation of the working class here and the world over.
Yeah, an event starts at 11 o'clock and there's speakers from 1
yes.
o'clock and then the march takes off at 2 o'clock. A pity it doesn't still go to the Yarra Bank, which was part of Labor history, but...
Yes.
But it, at least it's happening. It's good at 2 o'clock. And, of course, there's the wreath-laying ceremony, which is an annual event at the 8-hour Memorial opposite Trades Hall tomorrow night at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock tomorrow night.
That's right.
Yeah, okay, Jack. Well, look, thanks for your time this morning. And I hope we've made May Day seem a bit more real to many people.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy May Day, comrade. Happy May Day to your listeners. And let us struggle on, comrade.
Okay. Keep the struggle going, Jack. Okay. Righty, yeah. Jack Howard there, who, as you can tell, is knows a fair bit about Labor history. And you didn't sort of throw yourself into that conversation, but there you are.
I was listening and learning, Kevin.
Oh, right. Okay.
Always learning. I always get confused about the May Day holiday. Why isn't it on May Day? But there you go.
Well, it should be. It should be. But... anyway, you can either abandon Anzac Day and have May Day the holiday, or just have both anyway. Although that would, of course, cause massive problems with the investment, wouldn't it, Anne?
Are we going to be back next week, Kevin?
Yeah,
transport next week.
Yeah.
All right, same bat time, Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll be here.
Stay with us now on 3 for Anarchist World this week coming up.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.